Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Veterans Day, November 11th, 2018, a Sunday. This is episode 1540. Enjoy, and thanks for your service. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by On Deck. Are you a small business owner in need of capital today? With On Deck, you can get great help. Over $10 billion in loans, an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. On Deck is a lender you can trust. Visit ondeck.com/techguy to learn more and receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. And by LastPass, secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. And by Grammarly. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently. Go to grammarly.com/techguy to get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We're going to talk smartphones. We're going to talk smartwatches. We're going to talk iPads and MacBook Airs and Mac Minis. 8888, ask Leo the phone number if you want to call in and talk to me, talk to the world about your tech woes. 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, you can still reach us. All you have to do is use Skype. And when I say us, I mean me and Kim. Kim Schaffer answering the phones today. What do we came up with a name for you. The phone...
Angel.
Phone angel. Phone angel. Phone angel.
Like Charlie's Angels.
I like it. All right, angels. Get the phones.
Oh, did you?
He was always on a speakerphone, kind of like me. You never see me. I've been playing with new Mac Minis, new MacBook Airs, and the new iPad. The Mini and the Air, you don't need to say much about. They're exactly what you think. They're new Macintosh computers. The Air is, I likened it yesterday to home cooking. It's very nostalgic to use the MacBook Air. It's the computer that came out in 2008. Changed laptop computing. It was the first, well, they didn't call it this Ultrabook, but that's what the Intel world called it, and every manufacturer started making these super thin light laptops, Ultrabooks, modeled really on the unibody aluminum MacBook Air. Everybody made one. The Mac Mini hadn't been updated in 4 years, and it's exactly like the old Mac Mini. So very nostalgic for the Mac Mini and the MacBook Air. Much needed updates, obviously. But not really much to say about them. On the other hand, the iPad, it's an interesting beast. And I mean beast. There's been a lot of writing about the new iPad. A new 11-inch iPad Pro and a 12.9-inch iPad Pro. And I purchased the big one. 12.9 because they did, you know, the first, I had a 12.9 when it first came out 2 years ago, and it was too big. It was too big. It was a pizza box. It was just too giant. This one is the same size screen, but they've shrunk the frame down to the point where it's just, you know, it's just good. It's big, but it's good big, not bad big. I like it. And everybody has remarked, and I won't be the first to say this, this thing is remarkable. It's the computer of the future. Up to a terabyte of storage, so everything can live on here. If you want, you can get LTE connectivity, which I did, because and then it's always connected to the internet, which means storage is even less relevant because you can put stuff in the cloud too. This newly designed pencil is a marvel. It magnetizes and sticks to the top of where it's charging. But the thing that's most interesting about the new iPads is the processor. And it is a grown-up version a bigger version, a big boy version of the processor in the new iPhone XS and XR. It is an A12X Bionics. The X is interesting because it is actually a much more sophisticated chip than in the phone, which is the A12. With the X, they have added some remarkable stuff. Well, for instance, it is an 8-core processor. This isn't a tablet, folks. Apple said, and I think everybody's agreeing after testing, this is faster than 92% of the laptops sold this year. It's faster than the vast majority of laptops. 8 cores, 4 high energy, high speed, 4 low power, but you can combine them all 8 at once if you really need some horsepower, which means this thing is fast. 7 GPUs, a neural processor, a machine language chip. This thing is kind of remarkable. And it's Apple showing off in a way, because they have over 1,000 chip designers. They bought a chip company some years ago, and they're making their own designs. They also, and this is a little more geeky, but this is the first 7-nanometer chip in mass production. And when I say mass, I mean when Apple makes kind of a lot of these. You know, 10, 20, 30, 50 million is mass. This thing is super fast. And what everybody has noticed in this is you have basically the computer of the future. You know, this is amazing. Beautiful screen, very lightweight, kind of, just a slab of glass, gorgeous. In every respect, this is what, if you were a science fiction writer, you would say, oh yes, in the 2020s, the computers looked like this. Running software that essentially is unchanged since maybe 2010. It's iOS just doesn't live up to the promise of this hardware. And it's really puzzling. I guess not, because in the way of the world, it's not unusual for hardware and software not to be completely in sync. Sometimes hardware leads, sometimes software leads. Usually it's hardware first, then software. And that's what's happened here. And one hopes that Apple is taking this seriously and putting a lot of energy into making iOS live up to what the iPad can do. Because this thing is amazing. Now, if you have certain workflows, you'll be happy with this. Photographers, actually, if they can put up with a few little nitpicks using Lightroom and Apple's Photos and, you know, Snapseed, Luma, you know, there are quite a few photo editing programs, really Lightroom and Apple Photos primarily, Affinity Photo maybe a little bit. But if you're a photographer and your workflow can kind of conform to this, it's a revelation. I was reading a photographer who said, the way I edit photos, the way I process photos is completely different now with the pencil and the new iPad Pro. It's completely different and better. So there's people, if you're an artist and you like to draw, Procreate and the pencil, amazing. But I think so many people will buy this and end up just watching Netflix movies on it, and it really is overpriced for that. This costs as much as a laptop. You should look at the $329 iPad, and that's a perfect Netflix movie machine. Doesn't have the A12X Bionic. It doesn't have, you know, all the new swoopy-doopy features, but for watching Netflix, it's more than enough. And it's $329. You'll be spending almost $2,000 when you're fully equipped an iPad Pro, especially if you get the 12.9-inch with the keyboard, the pencil. And that's a lot of money for a Netflix machine. It's a laptop price. So there are some people who will be able to take advantage of it now. The rumor is Apple wanted to put new, I don't want to say desktop class, because that's looking backward, right? Whatever it is that this thing is, this new futuristic thing, they wanted to support it better with iOS, and they had to put that off. But maybe iOS 13, lucky 13, will have the features, things like simply accessing off iPad storage. The fact that they put a USB 3.1 Type-C connector, not a lightning connector, not the proprietary lightning connector, but a standard connector on this to charge it. I don't know why you'd want to do this. You could get a screen out of it. I guess people would. You can do all sorts of things with it, but Apple has to support, for instance, you can't put a keyboard or a mouse on there because Apple doesn't support it, doesn't have a driver for it. You can't put external storage on there because Apple says, well, I think it's a camera. They won't understand it. So there's things this ought to be able to do that it can't. I only bring this up because you may be tempted. I was tempted. You look at this and go, oh, it's a sexy beast. And unless you know the workflow that you use will apply well to this, writers may not be so happy, for instance. It might be worth saying, well, laptop is still easier. But I have a feeling that we are seeing in some ways the future of computing with this amazing piece of hardware. Just remarkable. And it's great for watching Netflix on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Kim Schaffer, the phone angel. Phone angel. Phone angel. You're my angel tonight. Hello.
Didn't hear any music, so something. Yeah. There's a disconnect.
I'm singing.
Somewhere.
That's called it's music. It's called you. Music. You don't like my singing?
I didn't know what the bumper music was, so
yeah.
There is no bumper
that's
music.
That's my singing.
All right.
Who should I talk to today?
You're really good at spending other people's money, right?
That's the truth.
Okay, so we got Clarence in Chesapeake, Virginia, and he's looking at a 50-inch TV, and he just heard this thing called Hisense, and I think he needs a little...
We happen to have... You're looking at one right now, you know that?
I?
That's what that is.
All of them? Which one?
The big one over your left
one.
Shoulder. The giant one.
The 100-inch.
The hundo.
It's not on today, which is so odd.
No. No, I think Hisense wants it back.
Oh, it didn't want it back.
Well, hey, these things happen. Let's go to the phones. Thank you, Kim.
You're welcome.
Hello, Clarence. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo, you just kind of caught me off guard. You said that big one, and I realized, wait a minute, I'm looking at a Hisense.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not really familiar with them. I'm looking at getting a 50-inch, and it's got a tuner in it. It's got... basically, it looks like everything I want. It's going to replace the 32-inch Philips, which it will fit in the shelf cabinet that I have. And
So Hisense and TCL are two new names in the TV business. They're both Chinese manufacturers. And so if you think about the history of television... Remember your RCA Philco? You're probably not old enough to remember that. But in the early days of TV, they were made, you buy a TV like Zenith, made in the U.S. of A. Then in the 60s and 70s, the Japanese manufacturers started to take over, and the best TVs were Sony and Panasonic. And they ruled for years. But then the Korean manufacturers, who up to that point had sold cheap TVs, from South Korea. You may remember the name Lucky Gold Star. They were in the back of the drugstore, you know, the cheap small TV you could buy in the back of the drugstore. Lucky Gold Star. Well, Lucky Gold Star's CEO said, you know, why don't we make Sony money? We should make premium sets and take over some of that market. So Lucky Gold Star renamed itself to LG, Samsung. The Korean manufacturers completely clobbered Panasonic and Sony to the point where even though they still make TVs, Panasonic, stopped selling in the U.S., and Sony makes more money selling insurance in Japan than they make in the television business. It was all for years Samsung and LG over the last maybe 10 years. Well, the same thing seems to be starting to happen in China, that these Chinese manufacturers... And the two we're most, interested in are TCL and the one you mentioned, Hisense. TCL now brands itself as America's fastest growing TV brand. They're made in Huizhou, Guangdong Province. They're a Cantonese company. But I have to tell you, I bought my mom, the most recent TV I bought my mom, a beautiful 4K TV. For a few $100s, it has Roku built in, was a TCL. And I'm looking at the nicest projection TV I've ever seen. It's in our studios. It's from Hisense. It's a 100-inch short-throw projector. So these companies make very good products. And because they're anxious to get into this new market, they're giving us amazingly low prices. And that's how you get in the market. You sell it at you know, I don't think it's below cost, but you sell it at a great price. Hisense on their website says, "Hi, pleased to meet you." Even though Hisense is one of the largest TV brands on the planet, with all kinds of stuff available in over 130 countries, it's possible you've never heard of us. They also make refrigerators and beverage chillers as well as TVs.
Okay.
They're the next Samsung, in other words. If you look at reviews and you want maybe the best TV you can get, you might still be going to a Korean or Japanese manufacturer. The LG OLEDs, the OLEDs from LG, are probably the best screens out there still. Sony makes amazing OLEDs. The Samsung QLEDs are very good. But if you're looking for price performance, remember we used to go to Vizio, and we still do. They're an interesting combination of Chinese and American. They're made in China, but it's an American headquartered company run by Chinese people, so that's confusing. These TCLs and Hisenses, I think, are very good TVs. Did you look at it? Is the price right and everything else good?
Yeah, the R7 is one I'm looking at. It's a 50-inch with a tuner for $329.
Isn't that mind-boggling? Is that mind-boggling?
It blows me away. I got a Vizio M-Series. I put that in the bedroom, but I wanted to, you know, put back in the living room a TV, and I was getting get a Vizio, a P or an M, but I need a tuner in it.
Yeah. Yeah, Vizio is one of the first companies to drop those out completely. And it just depends. You know, one of the reasons they're doing that is a lot of people like me say, I just want a monitor. I don't want smart. I don't want anything. I just want a monitor that I can hook up to my TiVo box and my Roku box. All of that stuff's external anyway, so I don't need it. But if you need a tuner, yeah. I think, like I said, I bought my mom a TCL. I bought her a 50-inch, 55-inch for the living room and a 43-inch for the bedroom, and they were like a few $100. Don't tell Mom I'm so cheap. But they're great
she
TVs.
She always has replacements.
Yes. Yeah, right. At that price, it's amazing. And so, it's because they want to get in this market. And who knows? Maybe when they become a big brand like Sony or Samsung, they'll start to raise the prices. But for now, I think but either company's an excellent value. If you like the TV, I'd say go for it. Now, okay. There is a question. There's always a question when you have a company that's not based in the U.S. about what service and support will be like. But service and support on these flat panels, especially at this price, becomes secondary to me. In most cases, there is no way they can service them anyway. So if you get it from a local retailer, they'll honor the warranty. But nobody's going to come out and fix it. It's not like the old days of the TV repairman who comes with a tool kit, opens the thing up and replaces a tube. These things are solid-state electronics, and they're kind of all glued together. It's kind of like modern laptops and phones. They're not repairable, really. So I think service...
Is it extended?
Yeah. If you're getting it from a local retailer, maybe. I wouldn't worry about it. At that price...
Best Buy.
Best Buy has a very good warranty. They back it up. So as long as Best Buy is selling it, I think you got nothing to worry about. Man, and these are so inexpensive. So what if they broke in 3 years? We have to kind of change our way of thinking. It used to be you buy a TV in the last two decades. Not anymore. Technology changes too fast. Our show today brought to you by, a new sponsor. Welcome, On Deck. On Deck is 100% committed to small business owners like me with fast, easy, and tailored financing. When you're in a business, and you know this if you're a small business owner, cash flow can be sometimes a problem. You got to make a widget, you got to sell a widget, but you're not going to get paid for the widget for 60 days. Or maybe, you know, you've got to staff up because the holidays are coming, but you don't get that holiday revenue right away. That's where On Deck comes in. Your time is valuable. You want to be able to do this fast as 24 hours, with term loans up to $500,000, lines of credit up to $100,000, and I love this, none of which require business collateral. Simple application process. You can apply online or do it by phone and get approved like that in minutes. And by the way, and this is also really important for me as a small business owner, it will not impact your personal credit. Nope. On Deck delivers some of the best customer service with their U.S.-based loan specialists. Better Business Bureau A+ rating. And they've been doing this for a long time. They've lent over $10 billion to over 80,000 small business owners. Trustpilot gives them a 9.8 out of 10 rating. It's as good as you can get on Trustpilot. OnDeck. It's a secure financing service that business owners everywhere can truly rely on. Holidays are coming. I know cash is tight. It's like a little bit of a, just makes you feel a little bit better. Gives you a little bit of cushion. And by the way, their simple and secure web platform and mobile app make it easy to maintain your account anywhere, anytime. So if you're a small business owner and you need access to capital, ondeck.com/techguy. And by the way, because you listen to Tech Guy, you'll get a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan representatives so they can help you tailor it exactly to your needs. Apply online, apply by phone, get approved in minutes. We're going to recap here, get the money fast. Go to ondeck.com/techguy, O-N-D-E-C-K, on deck. Like all hands on deck, ondeck.com/techguy. Get a free consultation right now. It's good to know, you know, you may not need it right now, but it happens to us all the time, you know. Cash gets tight. You got a payroll to make. You want to do this, get it quick, pay it back quick. ondeck.com/techguy. We thank you for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. On to phone line two. Rob in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Leo. And I got to tell you, you're talking to a grandfather who is much younger because of the technological information I get from you and your podcast.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have to say that I worry sometimes that, oh, you know, here I am getting older. Maybe the kids won't listen to me when I talk about tech. But the truth is, the kids they're not interested in tech. It's us that are interested in tech, and we get to change and find new things and all sorts of stuff. The kids just say, well, give me my Instagram. I don't really care about anything else. So
yeah, well, I got some techie kids, but anyway.
Oh, that's good.
Irrespective.
Yeah, I want to promote that with kids. I want them to learn how to be programmers and become techies. Because who's going to make the next generation of cool stuff?
That's right. We got to have that STEM education stuff.
That's bingo. Thank you. Thank you. You're absolutely right. Yeah. So what can I do for you?
Well, I am about to go buy a brand new MacBook Air at the Apple Store in Cincinnati tomorrow evening. But my current MacBook Air has had a problem for a while, and that's with something that I've discovered on the activity monitor that's sucking up my CPU.
Uh-oh.
Called User Event Agent. Yeah. And I don't know what, I've looked on forums, and there are so many different explanations of what's causing it, and I don't know. Got any help from you on that?
Yeah. I mean, this is part of the operating system. User events are things like mouse clicks, keyboard presses. So it's running always in the background, monitoring, you know, your key presses and things like that. You have to have it. It's not something that you can, you know, stop. In fact, if you've in the activity monitor tried to stop it, you might find yourself with an unresponsive computer. So
I haven't done that, fortunately.
Yeah, don't mess with it. Modern operating systems are designed to use all the resources available to them. And sometimes I think people get in trouble when they're looking at the task manager or the activity manager. They look at this and they go, oh, my gosh, you know, something's using 100% of RAM or 100% of CPU. We can't let that happen. But in fact, that's exactly how modern computers are designed. I mean, why would you not use all the processor and RAM? The key is that if something else needs it, you back down. You say, oh, yeah, okay. You can have some RAM, you can have some CPU. If something's hogging all the CPU and RAM and not backing down, and that'll make your system very sluggish, maybe even unresponsive, that's not normal. Now, when you get your new Mac, a couple of things are going to happen. First of all, your old Mac is old. Right? When did you get that MacBook Air?
It's a 2012 midsummer or something.
Okay, well, it's not that old, but remember that they didn't really much update it except to put newer processors in it. So the first thing that's going to happen, you're going to get Mac OS Mojave. You're going to get the latest operating system. That's what comes with the new MacBook Airs. You're going to get a faster processor. Now, a number of people have made kind of noises about how, oh, this is disappointing, this new MacBook Air, it only has a Intel Y processor, which is a low-power mobile chip. But having played now with the MacBook Air for 4 or 5 days and put it through the ringer, it's funny because I keep all the boxes for everything I buy, right?
Me too.
Because you don't know. Maybe I'm going to, and Apple's pretty good about taking it back within the first 2 weeks. I just gave John all my boxes for the MacBook Air, the iPad. I said, John, I'm keeping it. I wasn't sure about the MacBook Air. Mom's, you heard me say it. It's exactly what it is. It feels, you will love it because they haven't changed it so much that it feels like a different computer. It's just your old MacBook Air made better, much better screen. Processor actually is pretty fast. It's fine for everything I do, more than good enough. And I did buy the top of the line MacBook Pros they released earlier this year with a super fast i9 6-core processor and all that. And yeah, I have it, but I doubt I'll ever use it. The MacBook Air is thin, light, and fast enough for most everything I do, including, you know, some heavy duty stuff like photo editing and computer programming. It's fine. So anything that's going on with your old MacBook Air will probably be fixed. Here's my suggestion. You might be tempted to use the migration assistant. I don't know how recently you bought a new Mac, but nowadays when you get a new Mac, it says, well, you can set this up fresh, or you can migrate over from your old Mac. In this case, I would do it. It doesn't migrate operating system stuff. It doesn't migrate. It will migrate settings, things like that. I can't remember if it migrates applications. It may or may not. But
I think it does.
But I think it should. I think it says it gives you three choices, and you cannot get the applications. If you think you might have a rogue, you know, an application that's rogue, then maybe you don't want to migrate that over. But
every once in a while when I'm running Keynote, the fan will start coming on. Or sometimes when I'm running Pro Tools and have a voiceover to do, the fan comes on and at a remote location, and then I can't record anymore unless I log off and log back on, and then it goes away.
Yeah, the MacBook Air, the new MacBook Air, is reputed to have a very loud fan. I don't know because I haven't heard it in 5 days of really banging on it. I did a clean install on the MacBook Air. I did not do the migration assistant. My wife did a migration assistant. It took a long time. I didn't because I like to start fresh, and also it gives me an opportunity to rethink, well, why am I installing that? Am I ever going to use that? So I always start fresh. You haven't had a new computer in a few years. Maybe it's time just to say, open it up, start using it. The nice thing is if you go to the Mac App Store, any purchases you've made there will all be highlighted in your account. You can say, yeah, I want that, I want that, I want that.
That sounds good.
That makes it easy. Yeah, I would say you're going to love it. You're going to love it. It's mom's. I love it that you remember that. It's mom's home cooking. I don't know how to any other way to describe it. It's like going. It's a little nostalgic. It's like, oh, I remember this. This was a great computer. And battery life is excellent. I feel like this might be the best Mac laptop out there. It really is good. It's thin, light, fast enough, and really feels good in the hand.
Hey, one quick other thing. Earlier this year or late last year, you read an article on Wired magazine about a guy named Aaron Cashatt who was breaking into hotel rooms.
Yeah.
I was one of his victims.
No kidding.
Scottsdale, Arizona, $16,000 in stuff, including two laptops, iPads, iPhones. Fortunately, our travel documents and our IDs were in the safe. Otherwise, and two Martin guitars, too.
Oh, no.
Yeah, never did get those back.
Pretty
much everything was insured.
I am sorry, Rob. Are you a musician?
I am.
Those are nice guitars.
Thank you. Yeah, I was out at what was then the Kingston Trio Fantasy Camp in Scottsdale as a guest.
Oh, I know you, Rob. All right, now I know who you are. Yeah, awesome.
When you said Aaron Cashatt, the hair stood up on my arms. I said, holy crap, they caught him again.
The Andy Greenberg wrote the story in Wired, the hotel room hacker. And the way he gets in is, you know, it really is the fault of the hotel. And you might even have a case against the hotel because these electronic door locks were known to be hackable. He just walk around. He was a meth addict, walk around. He'd use a little bit of electronics, open the doors, take what he wanted, walk out.
One of the computers was recovered, and one of the phones recovered with videos of him on it. It was just gross.
Oh.
And I held in my hand. He was arrested in Ohio, and I held in my hand the device he used to get into my room.
Oh.
It was crazy.
Hey, I'm so sorry that happened. It's a violation. Even if you get everything back, it's like you want to take a shower. You want to wash your hands.
But I made a lot of friends that I wouldn't have made otherwise, so I consider it a wash. But anyway, hey, Leo, thanks for everything.
Thanks, Rob. My pleasure. It's great to talk to you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. What a nice... Rob, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Leo. I am so honored to be able to get on your show and chat with you. You have been, seriously, what I have learned from you with my techie kids, including one daughter who's working for CrowdStrike out in California.
Oh, neat.
She was one of the first 55 employees, and she's making more money than any of us.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course.
But keeps me, it really keeps me on an edge to talk with my kids in areas where they're, very much more advanced in terms of their generation. So I really enjoy the show.
Oh, that's nice.
Thanks a lot.
So tell me where I can, are you coming to town soon?
Closest I'm coming is March in Salinas for the air show. I was there back in September.
Oh, fun.
But quite frankly, I'm tempted, after it's over. But of course, I'm working Saturday and Sunday, but it would be fun to get back up and see the show sometime.
Is this the video of you on YouTube, Rob Ryder and the Kingston Trio? Is that you?
Probably, yeah.
At the fantasy camp, yeah.
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 And now they call it the Americana Camp, and I'm one of the staff members. So
how
I'm
fun!
Accompany and teach.
How fun! This is the 2013 Kingston Trio Fantasy Camp.
Yeah.
Yeah. How fun!
The year before was when we had the break in 2012. But honest to goodness,
I made friends
that have been so worth it, Leo.
Oh my gosh! That's interesting. Other victims or law enforcement or how did that?
No, just people from the camp, friends that I never would have made.
Oh, yeah.
People at Martin Guitar that I got to know because of that. And,
oh, good. Well, I hope they replaced your Martin.
Well, it was insured. That long story short, that happened on a Friday. The next Tuesday, I had one of the two Martin guitars replaced already.
Oh, I'm so relieved.
So, yeah.
Nice to talk to you, Rob. Come back.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks, Leo.
All right, Rob. See you later.
So long.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. The MacBook Air and the Mac Mini that Apple announced and shipped last week are interesting because all the innovation that Apple announced was in the iPads. There's basically zero innovation in the Mac Mini and the MacBook Air, but actually that's probably what we wanted. That's probably what we were looking for. The new Mac Mini is exactly the same shape. The on-off switch is in exactly the same spot, and that's because so many businesses have these in racks, and the on-off button is controlled by a lever. What they added is exactly what everybody wanted, which is more powerful processors, faster hard drives, bigger hard drives, and lots of, on the Mac Mini, lots of connections, lots of ports. This is the opposite of where Apple's been going with other hardware. They've been reducing the number of ports. The new MacBook Air has just two Thunderbolt 3 ports. The Mac Mini has a full-size regular everyday Ethernet jack, four Thunderbolt 3 ports, two USB 3.1 Type-A ports, and a full-size HDMI port, and a headphone jack, and a partridge in a pear tree, all of that on the back. And that's because Apple obviously talked to the people who buy Mac Minis and said, what do you need? And this is what they said. This is what they said, because it's used in studios. If you go to a Broadway show, Mac Minis and the soundboards. If you go to a video production, so this Mac Mini will go to our video production. That's where you're going to see these. And it's fast enough. They put enough processor in here, very fast desktop class chips. This could be a pretty good desktop computer. Of course, they raise the price. But who's lowering the prices these days besides Hisense and TCL? But all the innovation was in the iPad. MacBook Air, they kept it the way it was. They, reduced the number of ports. Now it has two Thunderbolt 3 ports and a headphone jack. But in every other respect, it's exactly like the old MacBook Air. It's just better screen and faster processors. And that's what I think that's what people want. It's certainly what I'm happy with. That was an almost perfect laptop. Why not keep it the same? Why change things? Karen in Ventura County, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay.
What can I do for you?
I've been having a problem with my Yahoo account. I go to libraries and public places to use my the internet to access my own Yahoo account.
Uh-huh.
And when I subscribe to something, I've been noticing that I'm getting duplicates. So I deleted it and then, you know, asked them to send me their subscription, and then it came back triplicate.
Oh, no. Oh, no. That's not really Yahoo's fault. That's the people who are, it's a newsletter you're subscribing to?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's them. They aren't using very good software because they should notice, for instance, if you're using mailing list software, it should notice that you're sending three copies of the same thing to the same address and just send one. That's nothing Yahoo can do about it. I don't think Yahoo's accidentally duplicating it. Furthermore, when you discontinued the emails, they didn't. They just added another address. That does, again, not doesn't sound like it's Yahoo doing that. So I would talk to the people, you know, send them an email. You'll have to find not the email address that the newsletter comes from. That's usually not a monitored address. But you'll find an address like for support at that company and say, hey, you guys are sending me the same newsletter three times. Can you knock it off and just send me one? That has to be handled manually, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, because it's happening like with 20 of them. It just seems to be increasing.
Oh, it's happening with other subscriptions too.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Huh. So maybe it is. I mean, that you're right to think. That sounds like it's a Yahoo problem, not a problem with the email newsletters.
Well, I have to spend a lot of time just deleting duplicates.
I know. What a pain in the butt. Especially if you're on a library computer and, you know, you don't want to, you're not in your living room. You want to get it done.
Yeah, I only get an hour.
Unfortunately, Yahoo, you know this, the saga of Yahoo, they failed kind of, and then they got purchased by Verizon. And Verizon, I don't even know if Verizon knows what they're doing with Yahoo. The whole thing's kind of a mess, and I wonder if Yahoo Mail is kind of starting to go downhill. You don't want to change, though, because everybody knows that address.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Maybe.
Maybe it's time to change. If you don't care, and maybe you want a fresh slate, try using Google's mail instead, which is actively maintained. Google's always working to make it better. Sometimes people say, I don't want to use Google Mail because they read my mail for ads. Actually, they don't anymore. They stopped doing that. And Yahoo still does. So that's how they pay for free services, is advertising. So Gmail is no longer monitoring your email, except for spam filtering, things like that. You might want to just throw the whole thing out. You don't have to throw it out. You have to do anything with it. Just start a Gmail account. They're free also. Unlike Yahoo, Gmail doesn't charge for Gmail. Yahoo has a free tier and a pro tier, a paid tier, and the service is much better in the paid tier than it is in the free tier. Gmail is all free unless you're using it in business, but for individuals it's free. And so there's no incentive for them to say, oh, well, we're not going to give you nice features because you're not paying us. So I think Gmail is probably a better solution. Just set up a new account, a new Gmail account, subscribe to just the newsletters you want, subscribe once, and I bet you that whole thing goes away. And your Yahoo email account can just sit there and continue to receive triplicate copies of all your newsletters, and you can just ignore it. You don't have to ever log into it. Does that make sense?
Well, I'll give it a try.
Just remember that if you've told individuals, humans, your email address, and you expect email, like if you gave your mom your Yahoo address, your mom won't know that you've moved to Gmail. So you might have to tell some humans. But all those triplicate newsletters, get rid of those. GMAIL.com. It's really, I think, much better than Yahoo, to be honest with you. I think, and the real truth about Yahoo is it's kind of a failed company. Verizon bought it, not sure why. I think of all the services Verizon keeps around, Yahoo Mail, they're going to keep it because they kind of have to. So many people rely on it, but they're not going to put any effort into it or any money. I think this is probably a better way to do it. And then with Gmail, you can use filters. And if you start getting multiple messages from the same account, you can filter them out, things like that. And yeah, if you really wanted to, I'm not sure I'd recommend this, but you can configure Gmail to get your Yahoo Mail and bring it over to Gmail. Check every once in a while and bring it over. But it sounds like you don't want to do that because then you'll be bringing over those triplicate newsletter subscriptions too. You don't want to do that. One of the beauties, however, of a free email account is it's easy to start a new one. Go ahead and do that. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Yes, time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We talk smartphones. We talk smartwatches. We talk the new iPads, the new Macs. 888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada outside that area. You can still call. You just have to use Skype or something like that. It'll still be free, too, in most cases. Your mileage may vary. 888-ASK-LEO. That's the number. Marshall called from Des Moines, Iowa. Hello, Marshall.
Hello, Leo. I'm trying to find a iOS. I'm trying to take a iPad back to 11.4.1, and I was wondering if Apple
You want to go back to an older version of iOS? You upgraded to 12?
Yeah, and I was wondering if Apple allows you to download something similar to Windows.
No.
ISO files?
No. In fact, kind of intentionally, Apple prevents that. They unsign the old version. And so let me look here and see.
Because I'm at their website, and it shows I could get, for the iPad, it says 4.3.5. But
really? Wow. Yeah, because there's some versions, some iPads that can't use more modern versions.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe you can downgrade it, but you'll have to erase the whole thing. Do you mind?
Yeah, I've erased. I actually have the new iPad that I've just wiped a couple of times just trying to.
There's a window of time that you can do that. At some point, Apple will no longer allow you to do it because you won't be able to get iOS 11 anymore. But I don't know if that window of time has expired. So I'm gonna put a link in the show notes to an article at imore.com that describes it. And the reason I'm going to do that is because it's kind of tricky. You're going to be using something called the DFU reset. And you have to, it's kind of a, you know, you have to hold down a button for 5 seconds and release it just at the right time and then do all this stuff. And how you, and what you have, the hardware you have, it even varies, different versions. So device firmware update mode, you may not need it, but I suspect you will. You may be able to do it in recovery mode. In any event, the iMore article describes it. You can Google how to downgrade iOS, and you'll be able to find it on imore.com. Or I am going to put this in the show notes for you, so you can just click that link. It'll get up there in a minute or two. It takes a little while for James to copy the stuff out of my notes, but yeah, my fear is it might, the time might be over that you can do that. So in fact, according to Scooter X in the chat room, following the release of 12.0.1, which Apple just pushed out last week on Monday, Apple is no longer signing 11.4.1, so you can't go to 11.4.1. Does that mean you can go to a later version of 11? I'm not sure. You'll know. It'll say, nope, can't do it. That's the problem, is Apple doesn't want you to downgrade. And so unlike Windows, Microsoft, you can download an older version of Windows and go backwards in time if you don't mind erasing the hard drive. But with iOS, Apple probably does not want you to use older versions because they kind of like everybody on the same version. And they're always so proud. They always announce, oh, we got 80% of everybody's now using iOS 12 or whatever. They're always so proud of that fact. And the reason is for security, but also developers like to know that all the devices they're writing software for will have the same capabilities. So if your hardware can get to iOS 12, remember, some hardware can't. The early first iPads can't. I don't know if iPad 2 even can. So older hardware can't, but developers have kind of passed those by too. You may notice, in fact, if you have an older iPad, you can't run newer software on it. This is always a challenge. Always a challenge. And somebody's pointing out, yeah, on Mac OS, you can go backwards. On Macs, you absolutely can go backwards. It's just something that Apple's done with iOS, and I kind of understand why they do it. Apple's very good about leaving people with older stuff in the dust. Not good for the people with older stuff, but it helps Apple move forward more briskly, perhaps, than Microsoft can. Roland in Hutchinson, Kansas. Hello, Roland.
Hello, Lou. It's pronounced Roland, but that's okay.
Roland. Okay.
There you go.
All right. Is that the most common way to pronounce it, Roland?
It's kind of spelled wrong. It probably should have been spelled R-A-W-L.
Yeah.
But it was a family name spelled R-O-L, so I got what I got.
Roland. All right. Well, no, thanks for correcting me. I want to say it right. Thank you.
No problem. I'm wondering, is there a way, and I don't know if I have to switch to a Google phone number or not, but where I get sent out, like, say a multiple text, but without everybody receiving everybody's information.
Oh, yeah. Group text, kind of like blind copy. So that, okay, you know, when you do that with email, you do BCC, right? Nobody knows who else is on that email list.
Exactly.
Yeah. But how can you do that with...
I'm using an iPhone, if that matters.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that does matter. That does matter. I think that's a setting in iOS. I'm going to have to look. I think in group messaging you can say hi. This is an example of where Apple is really thinking about how people like to use stuff. Let me see if iOS will let you do that. I'm going to go to settings and messages. Of course, my iPhone has crashed. Thank you, Apple.
That's
not it. Yeah, it was easy to fix that. So let's see, messages, and we're going to look at group messages, group messaging. Huh. It doesn't say that there's a way to turn that off, but I feel like a group message, let me see.
You would think there'd be a way. I mean, I'm kind of thinking kind of like the way we had the announcement the other day from the president, the whole being careful or whatever, just a test. But I didn't see everybody else's phone number.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that, of course, is the presidential alert system. That is not that is a unique and, let's hope, seldom used feature. This is funny. Somebody sent me a link from a show in 2015 and where I answered that question. Apparently on iOS you can't do it, so you'll need to use some and this is the problem, is everybody has to be on it, a messaging service like WhatsApp, which will let you do that, but the downside of that is everybody else has to be using WhatsApp. You don't want to put them, you know, say, hey, I want to send you a group message and I don't want anybody to see the other thing.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't mind. I have Google Voice, so I mean, I could, if they have it, I could, you know, just change my number, and I guess that would be all right.
That's an interesting question, right? Could you do it in Google Voice? You cannot do it. You cannot do it, unfortunately, it looks like, in iOS. But
okay.
I'm just looking at an Apple note in the Apple communities. You're apparently not the only one who wants to do this. So can you do it in Google with Hangouts? I'll have to try it. If you're using Google Voice, you can use their Hangouts messaging app. And I would bet you could. Why? It's funny that Apple doesn't let you do that. That seems like an obvious thing that people would want. Let me do some research. See, yeah. I don't know what the answer is. You got me. Anybody knows, 8888 Ask Leo. We'll see if we can figure this out before we get back. Oh, is that you in Chictawaga, Archandra? That's cool. Let me send a group message. I'm going to try it. Let me say, let's see, group plus. New SMS. I'm going to send it to Leo. And I'm going to send it to Leo. And, oops. Leo, that Leo. Let's send it to my Pixel. And Leo. And let's send it to... my iPhone. This is why it's good to have multiple. Why did it... okay. Did it erase it? New SMS. Leo. Oh, maybe SMS, you can't do a group. Is that the problem? And here, maybe I'll send it to Kim. Oh, that's a different Kim. John. Send it John. Jammer B. Okay. Good. All right, so I've got two people testing. So, John, tell me if you can see the number of the other person on the messages. Did you get a testing message?
Oh, look at that. Look.
It says to you and John, and it shows both phone numbers.
Yeah.
So no, the answer is there's no BCC. Wow, that's a bummer. So I did an experiment. I sent a group text using Google's Hangouts. And guess what? It showed all the phone numbers of the different people. So that wasn't good. We're looking for a way to do a blind carbon copy, a BCC on a group texting. And you could do it, of course, in messaging apps like WhatsApp. Dr. Mom's got an app for you called Hit 'em Up. Hit 'em Up. It's an iOS and a Google app. Not free, but you could try it free for 7 days. And it says you can do... it actually sounds like it's a spam tool. Mass text, fast and personally. Become a trusted leader. Turning hours of personalized mass bulk texting into seconds. Earn more, get referrals, fast outreach, loyal followers. So this Hit 'em Up app looks like you could do group messaging using SMS on an iPhone. $250 a month when you purchase a year. And there is a 7-day free trial. So... it's Hit, it's actually Hit, M-E-M, Up, app.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. Thank you, Dr. Mom. Hit 'em Up, app.com. Let you send blind carbon copies. But don't use it for spamming, please. That would be wrong, and it's probably illegal. In fact, I got to give some credit. I slam the chairman of the FCC all the time, Ajit Pai, for his stance on net neutrality. But I have to give him some credit because he's taken a stand on robo-dials and spam calls. And this was a much-needed stand that the FCC has not taken for a long time. He slammed Sprint and Charter and CenturyLink. He says seven big carriers haven't promised to use new robocall blocking technology. He issued a press release, sent letters to wireless carriers. He says... by the end of next year, you've got to implement Shaken and Stir. No, it's not a James Bond meme. Shaken stands for signature-based handling of asserted information using tokens. Oh, please. Stir stands for Secure Telephone Identity Revisited. They are literally industry standards. Obviously, somebody who loves James Bond made up the acronyms. Under the Shaken Stir framework, calls traveling through interconnected phone networks, in other words, from Sprint to AT&T or so forth, would be signed as legitimate by the originating carriers, validated by other carriers before reaching consumers. That means people wouldn't be able to use mass bulk robocalling technologies. A lot of the reasons we're getting so many robocalls right now is because it's cheap. It's free, basically, because they, instead of using telephony, you know, plain old telephone service, a phone to do it, they're using software and voice over the internet protocol software to make these calls. So it's very inexpensive for them. I'm not convinced Shaken and Stir will solve that, but I guess what it could do is let your it probably be a switch. I'm guessing it would be a user configurable setting, but you could say, I don't want any calls that aren't signed. And that would eliminate a lot of robocalls. The same way you could say, I don't want any emails that aren't signed. They're not authenticated. Now, the reason people don't do that, you could do it, but they don't do it, is because they don't, you know, they might want to get calls from some people and emails from some people. But this Shaken and Stirred framework at least gives us some sort of way to eliminate robocalls. And it's just out of control, isn't it? One of our chatters suggested a program called Nomo Robo. And I tried it on iPhone. But the problem with Nomo Robo and a lot of similar tools, including the Do Not Call Registry, Nomo Robo relies on a list of known spam numbers. But these spammers, these robocallers, are able to make up any phone number they want at any time. And so I found that Nomo Robo did catch a lot of robocalls, and what it does is sends it right to voicemail. But it didn't catch a lot. And I want a solution that's going to catch them all. I guess reducing the number is good. Some of you, I know, I've talked to some of you listening who've received, dozens of calls a day. They can no longer use their smartphone. It's just so many. It was bad, of course, during the election season. But actually, I didn't get as many robocalls, maybe because I'm in California, from candidates and propositions. I got a lot of text messages, which is almost as bad. But I didn't, oddly enough, I did not get a lot of phone calls. Did you get a lot of phone calls? The problem is that you can block an individual number, but they change numbers pretty regularly. So it's pretty hard to block them that way. The Do Not Call Registry doesn't work because a lot of these guys come from overseas where they are not beholden to U.S. law. But this effort, I think, would help. I suspect the way carriers will implement it is they'll have a switch you can set that says, I don't want to receive unauthenticated calls, because they're not going to automatically block calls that aren't signed unless you say, I want that. Sprint didn't want to do it because they said it's not a complete solution and it's expensive. Sprint said the cost of implementing the certificate management requirements of Shaken encourages the commission and industry to explore more cost-effective alternatives. Shaken and Stir, besides having a great name, and T-Mobile said this, is going to work if you're willing to reject calls that are unsigned. And T-Mobile said, you know, the problem is it can't confirm the call is fraudulent. It can only say it's not fraudulent. So if you're getting an international call, for instance, even if it's not fraudulent, maybe it's from family overseas, it might be rejected because international providers don't participate in Shaken and Stir. The majority of fraudulent calls come from outside the U.S. So until you get international phone companies to go along, this is going to be a non-starter. We'll see. They're doing something, right? Gotta commend them for at least doing something. It's kind of a mess out there. Do you get a lot of robocalls? Have you tried? I put all my phone numbers on the Do Not Call Registry. Did not seem to reduce it. But I noticed my wife says, oh, no, it works for me. She doesn't get so many robocalls. So I just don't know. Maybe my number is on a list. I don't think so, though. I think my sense of robocalls is just call numbers randomly, right? There is, as Archandra in our chat room points out, a similar system out there for email and for spam, but it's just not widely implemented. And it has the sometimes negative result of blocking mail you want, as this would as well. So it's not a perfect solution, but we got to do something. It's just out of control. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, our digital photography guru, is coming up in just a little bit. We'll talk about using your camera to get better pictures, and we'll give you your assignment as well. I haven't mentioned that in a while. I can't even remember what it is, but Chris will know. And we'll take more of your calls. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. Don't forget our website where all this stuff lives, links, audio and video of the shows, after the fact, and more. TechGuyLabs.com, and it's free. No sign up. Mama, don't take my Kodachrome. It's time for Chris Marquardt, who was in the home of Kodachrome for the last couple of weeks, but he's back from his trip to Rochester, New York. Hello, Chris. He's our photo guy. That's kind of going to Rochester is kind of like going to Mecca for photography.
It's like going to Mecca. I made sure I stopped by the George Eastman Museum, which is just if you are near Rochester, make sure to go there. It's a wonderful place to have great exhibitions. You get to see George Eastman's house. You get to walk through George Eastman's house.
It's like a pilgrimage for you. I mean, this is your vacation. It is, yeah. You go to Rochester, New York.
Well, I was visiting friends there. I also hung out at the photography department of the Rochester Institute of Technology, which is another amazing place. So
nice.
Yeah, it was good. Had a good time.
So what are we talking about today, Mr. Marquardt?
Well, you know, there's one thing about our cameras, and that is true for maybe not the smartphones, but all the cameras, like the interchangeable lens ones, like the mirrorless ones, the DSLRs, even compact cameras, they have a lot of buttons and a lot of symbols on them.
Yes, and they do.
And some of them are like standardized. Each kind of has its function, and they are kind of standardized, at least to a certain extent. So you will find the same type of symbols on different cameras. But then some of them are, of course, specialized by manufacturer. And I just wanted to go through a few of those, and one specifically, and I want to talk about that towards the end. So let's look at the lens first. If you have a camera, again, interchangeable lens cameras, they have like markings for the distance mm-hmm. in feet and mm-hmm. in meters usually. Mm-hmm. There's an infinity symbol on the distance scale. If you move the focus ring all the way to the edge, there is a little infinity symbol. But then next to that, you often find a little line, like an L on its side, which kind of shows you that infinity isn't really infinity. You got to back off a little bit. You'll find this on the one that you're just looking at on the zoom lens. If you rotate that front ring, then you can see the numbers changing. Yeah, there's a sideways L.
What
right?
is that? I've never even noticed that.
So, well, infinity. If you move it all the way to infinity, and you can hear this on my lens because it is kind of a manual focus lens, but you have to back off a bit in order to get real infinity.
What?
Those lenses go beyond infinity.
To infinity and beyond?
And beyond.
that L is like where you should be if you really... Infinity would be like focusing on the sky, distant object. It's not really infinite.
Or the moon or stuff like that. But don't take that L for
guaranteed. So back off a little bit.
Yeah, but don't take the L for guaranteed. It's you better check this through the camera to make sure that you're right.
I never knew that. I just always would do it all the way to the right. So that's not, or all the way to the left. So that's good to know. Back off a little bit and then look. Yeah.
Other things on the camera itself, if your camera has a flash, I mean, those are kind of simple. The flash symbol is universal.
Right.
The little trash can icon, of course, if you want to delete a photo, universal. The little play button shows you the pictures. That is universal.
Yeah.
You'll find a magnifying glass somewhere to zoom into photos. That is kind of universal. Another one that you will see in some cameras, either on a button or in a DSLR like yours, probably on in the menu, is when you change, well, for Canon it's called the drive settings. You'll see a lot of different symbols there. One is the self timer. That's a little circle with a diagonal line in it. and so on and so on. Okay, I don't want to really go into the details on that, but I want to show you one symbol that I'm not sure. I mean, most people will not know what this is. If you look on the shoulder of that camera,
okay,
on the right top, you will find a little circle with a line through it.
A little circle. Oh, a little circle with a line through it. Okay.
Can you see that?
Yeah. What the hell is that?
What the hell is that?
You know, I'm so used to having stuff on the camera that I don't know what it means. You see this all the time. What is that?
Most cameras have that. I'm not sure your Leicas have it because they are sort of really simplified.
Yeah,
but
they took all the buttons and features off of this thing. Yeah,
it might be on the bottom. It might be on the bottom. It might be hidden somewhere.
Yeah.
Usually it's on the cameras that are not smartphones. But most of them will have that.
Yeah, it's funny. This one
what
doesn't,
it
this
is,
Leica doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's not really that necessary anymore, but that is the focal plane indicator.
So that's where the sensor is?
That shows you where inside the camera, where the sensor physically is. If you would slice the camera through that line, you would pretty much touch the front of the sensor.
Now, why would I need to know that?
Well, you want to know that because in some applications, you want to be really precise with the distance of stuff from the camera. You have autofocus, and that is totally fine.
Right.
But in some circumstances, it helps to have that distance. Now, if you look at the lens has a kind of a focal distance scale.
Right.
That scale measures between where you focus and that symbol, not the front of the lens.
Okay. So when I see 1.5 feet,
it's from that symbol to where you're focusing.
Interesting.
That becomes interesting if you look at some of the lenses have a minimal focal distance pointed on them. So if that lens has, I don't know, 1 foot minimal focal distance.
Right.
That means from that symbol. So you could, if you have a physically long lens, you could almost be touching that thing with the front element because that is the distance.
Interesting.
Where this becomes really important, and you probably have seen this in the business, is in the film industry, because very often with cameras in Hollywood, they don't focus using just...
They use a tape measure. I've seen them.
They do use a tape measure, and some of those movie cameras, where that focal plane indicator is, they have a hook that you can hook in a tape measure.
Oh, how funny. Okay. All right.
That is what this symbol is for. So now you know.
That's okay. So most people aren't going to be using that, probably.
Oh, no, probably not. Yeah. But it kind of gives you an idea if with all these numbers on the camera, especially the closest focal distance. If that is 1 foot and your lens is almost a foot long, some of the longer telephoto lenses are, then you will end up, being very close to things. And in the past, I wondered why. Can I go this close when it says 1 foot minimal focal distance?
That cracks me up because what it just does is it adds the noise on the camera. There's all these things on the body. You really don't know what they do. And eventually you stop paying any attention to them. I mean, I've seen that thing for a long time. I guess I don't need it. But it kind of adds to the overall noise on the camera body. There's a lot of symbols.
It definitely does. Those cameras, especially the DSLRs, are very technical.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I like it. I pulled out my Leica Q because it's really, there's nothing on it. It's just you just put it in the mode you want and you shoot. And that's one of the ways Leica's selling this, frankly. So, interesting.
Yeah, Leica sells to non-technical people, for sure.
Yeah, artists like me. Yeah. I don't need those symbols. I'm an artist. Chris Marquardt's an artist, and he knows what the symbols mean. You can find out more about Chris at discoverthetopfloor.com. That's where his incredible photographic workshops are. And he's got books, including a book about film photography. And I'm going to get the brand new one. I'm excited on wide-angle photography. It's out now, right?
It is. It's in the stores now. An entire book on nothing but wide-angle photography.
I just bought a dedicated wide-angle lens because of that book.
That's the book for you?
Yep. Find out more. And then we also have a photo assignment. We'll talk about that when we come back because I want to make sure everybody gets some pictures in so Chris can do his photo review. It's coming up in the next week or so. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. On Veterans Day, the 100th anniversary of the armistice 100 years ago, 11/11/1918. Thanks to all who have served and gave their all for our country. Veterans Day, of course, celebrated tomorrow. I think we're having a parade today, though, in town, which is fun. I always love that, with a Huey helicopter flyover. Always fun. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Back to the phones we go, and on line one, it's Dr. Bird. Hello, Dr. Bird.
How are you doing there?
I am well.
Well, I'll tell you what, Chris, he talked about a very important icon. Matter of fact, I'm looking at my EOS 7D right here, right now.
Dr. Bird, we should mention, is a bird photographer.
And butterflies.
And butterflies. Birds. And butterflies. And anything with wings on it.
Oh, my God, Leo. No, when we're talking about trying to photograph a dragonfly, until they sit still.
Hummingbirds are hard, too, right?
Well, hummingbirds, what I like to do is... what other photographers do that do not use multiple flashes, and I deter anybody from using multiple flashes because you wind up blinding the poor little birds.
Aww.
Exactly. There are a lot of photographers do that, and I've literally seen blind hummingbirds after they get done.
But they're able to freeze the motion of the wings and the bird by using strobes.
Flashes.
Yeah.
So what I do, I use a single flash, and I think I do just as good as any of the other multiple flash photographer
guys. Dr. Bird, where can we see your photography?
Well, in a lot of calendars. I do a lot of calendar work for Workman Publications and Trout Publications.
Oh, I love Workman stuff. They do beautiful stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Also, some of the Audubon magazines.
Nice.
Yeah. And, of course, I just love doing my own photography on my own.
Well, wonderful. So, tell me again what you were shooting with.
Yeah, well, let me tell you about that right now.
Yeah.
Chris is exactly right. As a matter of fact, a lot of times, if I'm out and about photographing butterflies, and if I see any butterfly eggs... I have a tape measure inside of my photo vest. And so what I'll do, I'll use my 105 macro with an extension tube, because when you're trying to photograph a butterfly egg, you're talking about microscopic.
Yeah.
That's extremely microscopic. And Chris is exactly right. What you do, you line up on the right side of the 7D Mark II body.
Yeah.
And there's a little icon right next to the display.
Yep.
So since I am very visually impaired, I know what the minimum focusing distance with the 20-millimeter extension tube is with my 105. It's at 8.2 inches.
So you measure that out?
Literally. Literally measure it out. And I'll always carry a tripod.
This is what's hard about macro photography. Macro photography is, you know, essentially making something the same size in the photo as it is in real life. And with a butterfly egg, well, they must sounds like they're very tiny. That would be, you know, you're getting in pretty close. You're blowing it up by getting the camera in close. And, of course, you have to use a special lens to do that because it has to be able to focus at that very short distance. But it's also extremely difficult to focus.
Oh, it is. Matter of fact, a lot of times what I'll do, I'll take my 7D Mark II, I'll put it on manual focus, and I'll keep moving the focusing ring a little bit with a single point, because remember, on a 7D Mark II, you have 65 focusing points. I put it so where I have only one single focusing point, which is one click to the right when you're looking at all the focusing modes on the 7D Mark II, because that is my favorite camera to use, bar none, anywhere I go.
And why do you like the 7D Mark II for the kind of photography you do? Because every camera has certain niches that it's good at.
Well, number one, the 7D Mark II is relatively inexpensive for all the quality you get into the camera.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking 10 frames a second. We're talking ISO that will go as high as 51,200 ISO, which is extremely high for a consumer-level camera. And another thing, the thing that I like best about the 7D Mark II, it has a built-in flash.
Nice.
You cannot imagine how many times when I'm doing things like butterfly eggs or even insects at night, you know what? I don't bother getting out my ring light. I use my built-in flash.
Nice.
My built-in flash works absolutely fantastic. I mean, a ring light will do a little better than a built-in flash because it has more even lighting.
Right.
Instead of going over the top of the lens, it goes around the lens.
Right.
Yeah. But as far as photographing the butterfly egg, Leo, let me tell you, anybody out in your listening audience wants to do something challenging? That is extremely challenging. Number one, you first have to find the butterfly laying the egg, and then once you find that, then usually what I do is I take a little piece of yellow tape, I carry some with me, mark it on the branch, go back to my car if I don't have my tripod with me, go back, grab my tripod, come back, and then set on my camera, and then photographing the butterfly.
Now I really want to see what they look like. There's nowhere on the web I can see a butterfly.
Yeah, there are plenty of places on the web. Matter of fact, if you go to Orange County Natural History, Peter Bryant website, he has all different kinds of photos of different butterfly eggs, a lot more than I have.
Really?
He has photos of monarch eggs. He has photos of all different kinds of butterfly eggs.
Wow.
There are lots of, you know, insect photographers out there that provide photos on Google that have different butterfly eggs. I mean, this is something I've gotten into in the last year. Because
I never even heard of butterfly eggs.
Oh, yes.
Don't butterflies come from caterpillars?
Well, no. You got to remember the stage of a butterfly, Leo.
Okay.
First, you have the egg.
Yeah.
Then the egg usually takes between 10 and 14 days to turn into a caterpillar on the branch.
Yeah.
Then, once it goes from being a caterpillar, then it crawls around looking for leaves to chew on. And then it takes between...
I know that because I read the Very, Very Hungry Caterpillar book to my kids.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And see, there are caterpillar books out there. You have Caterpillars Out in the Field by Jeffrey Glassberg.
So,
and then you have all different kinds.
So really, it's not a butterfly egg. It's a caterpillar egg.
Right. Well, see, the caterpillar comes from the egg. And so here's the thing. The caterpillar has between one and four stages that it turns various colors and turns into various forms. And then it goes what's called into the chrysalis stage.
These are quite beautiful. I Googled some butterfly eggs. They're tiny, but they're also kind of graceful and pretty.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They certainly are. Lots of them have stripes on them, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very interesting.
So what we do here, Leo, is we have to trace down the butterfly egg. Then you look for the caterpillars. Of course, when you're looking for caterpillars, you go to the plant that you want to find the particular butterfly at where it goes into the stage where it eats leaves. So a lot of times when I'm out in the field, I look for a plant that has a bunch of eaten up leaves, and that's where I find the caterpillars.
And you do all this and you're low vision?
Yeah. Well, I'm very, very visually impaired.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
If you were to see how thick my glasses are, sometime I'll have to meet you. You have to see how thick my glasses are. My glasses are 5/8 of an inch thick.
He's doing this all through Coke bottles, kids.
Coke bottles. But you know what? Most of the time I'm wearing my contact lenses.
How thick are they?
Yes. I can tell you, whenever I have to do my photography with my glasses on, it's called no.
Yeah.
With my contacts on, that's it.
Dr. Bird, it's so good to talk to you. It's always a pleasure. I wish you got to make a Dr. Bird website.
I know. It costs a lot of money per month to have all the different photos up.
Mm.
The Flickr site for me is very helpful.
Oh, so you have a Flickr account. That's good. I love Flickr.
Yes.
What's your, can I tell people your Flickr handle?
All you need to do, go to Google.
Yeah.
Type in Gary S. Meredith.
Okay.
And in parentheses, put down Dr. Bird Photos. I'll take it right to my site.
Nice. I'm going to go look right now. Dr. Bird, a pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Remember, Leo, I am probably the only bird photographer you run into that does videos with birds, too.
Ooh.
I have birds going to bird baths.
I want to see a super slow motion of a hummingbird going into a bird bath. Oh, I'm looking. Oh, look, they're all on your Flickr, actually. That's nice. Dr. Bird Photos. On Flickr, he's Gary_S_Meredith. Thank you, Dr. Bird. Our show today brought to you by LastPass. Actually, our podcast today brought to you by LastPass. How can you not know about LastPass? You know about LastPass, right? It's the password vault, number one most popular, most preferred password manager. 16 million people use it. It's been around for a decade. I've been using it practically all that time. Look, we know that passwords are broken. It's a terrible system, right? I mean, when I grew up, you didn't have to remember passwords. You had to remember your high school locker combination. That's about it. But now we've got passwords for every app, every website, dozens of them, hundreds of them, actually maybe even thousands of them. You're supposed to remember them all? No. So either you use the same one everywhere. Bad idea. What if one of them gets hacked? Then all of them get hacked, right? Or you do something, and I know a lot of people do this, they do kind of the same password for everything. It's a variation of their birth date, the dog's name, and their phone number, or whatever. Easy to remember, but easy to remember almost always means easy to crack. So don't reuse passwords. Use good, long, LastPass generated passwords, but you don't have to remember them. You keep them in your LastPass vault. You only remember the one password to unlock the vault. And actually, I recommend you do that and use two-factor authentication. That way, even if a bad guy guessed your password or got your password, he still wouldn't be able to get in. He'd need your smartphone, too. LastPass even has a great authenticator app that doesn't – it's not even the six digits, right? It just pops up a notice and says, are you trying to log in to LastPass? Approve or deny. You press a button and you're in. LastPass is amazing. It's so good. I've been using it for so long. We actually now – offer it as a benefit for employees. Everybody gets a LastPass account. I want them to use LastPass. I want them to be secure, primarily because they have my passwords too, right? If you're a business, you want to use LastPass for business. There's either LastPass for Teams or LastPass Enterprise. And what it does is it lets you secure the keys to your kingdom, your bank accounts, your websites, your servers, all the things that your employees need access to, but you don't want them taking those passwords with them. You don't want them sharing them. You don't want them writing on a post-it note on the screen. It's really important. Secure your enterprise with LastPass Enterprise. If you use Active Directory, your active credentials will log you into your LastPass. That's nice. Data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. So it's completely secret even from LastPass. Only you know it. Autofill in iOS 12 now, Android Pie. Look, you got to try it. Go to lastpass.com/twit and set it up right now. lastpass.com/twit and get it for your business too. lastpass.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here. It's time to talk tech. I'm the tech guy, you know. This is the show where we talk about computers and the internet and home theater. We talk about digital photography. We talk about smartphones, smartwatches. We talk about butterfly eggs. We talk about butterfly eggs. Anything with a chip in it, except for the butterfly eggs. 8888-ASK. Leo is my number. Another hour to come on the Tech Guy Show, so give me a ring. I can answer your questions, help you buy something brand new, or help get rid of something that's old and in the way. 8888-ASK. Leo, the website where everything lives is techguylabs.com. Do electric bikes count? I think they have chips in the controllers. That's my new passion. I just got a bike from Rad Power Bikes, and I have another one on order from Lithium Cycles. And my wife likes the one we got from Rad Power so much, we bought another one for her with fat tires. And it's so. Have you tried an electric bike? It seems when the Segway, remember the Segway back, almost 20 years ago now? It was Project It, the Ginger. Everybody knew that Dean Kamen, who was this wizard inventor, had something amazing. And people in the tech community saw it and they were just going on and on, but they weren't allowed to say what it was. I remember Bill Gates said, cities will be reinvented around this. We were all so excited. And then Dean Kamen revealed the Ginger, Project It. And it was this weird scooter with two wheels that stood up on its own and you'd ride it around, the Segway. I have a Segway. I like my Segways. They're fun to ride, but you look like kind of like a dork riding them around because it makes you 7 feet tall, 8 feet tall on wheels. And there's just no way to look cool riding around in a Segway. But I like the idea of a silent, almost zero maintenance electric motor zipping you around town with no pollution, no gas. And we have solar panels in the house, so we even get the power for free. We just charge them up. And I love this idea. Just you look kind of like a nitwit. And my wife and I will ride our Segways around town, and I know people are staring and saying, what is that? Or they know it's a Segway and they go, oh, those guys are such dorks. There's one other couple in town that has Segways. That's it. But the electric bike, that looks like a regular bicycle. Maybe it's a little fatter because it's got a battery in it. They're heavier because they got a big old battery in them. But man, you look like you're just pedaling along, except when you get to a hill, and then all the regular bicyclists are huffing and puffing and sometimes even walking their way up the hill if it's steep enough, and you're just going sailing up the hill, going whoop. You're still pedaling. You have to pedal on an electric bike. Most of them are pedal assist, what they call them, which means the engine doesn't do anything unless you're pedaling. But it still does a lot of the work. So you're not pedaling hard. It's like you're going downhill on an uphill. And you don't look weird. You look like you're just riding a bike. Somebody, old gear in the chat room, says, how does a person stay in shape on an electric bike? Well, now, that's true. It's a lot easier. You don't get as much exercise as you would if you were pedaling up those hills. But you are still pedaling and you're still riding, and you can turn down the power assist, so it doesn't help you as much if you want more exercise, or you could turn it up if you want less. I'll tell you what, they come out of China. I remember when going to China about 10 years ago, 2009, there was traffic, but mostly it was bicycle traffic. You'd get to a stoplight and 100 bicycles would pull up. There was a lot of bicycle traffic. And then, of course, as time went by, and you see, by the way, you'd see cargo bikes. You'd see people pulling giant bales of hay and things in their bicycle, entire families on a bicycle. But I imagine, I haven't been to China since then, but I know that most of these motors, almost all of them, are made by Chinese companies. The Befang is the most popular, which is, by the way, kind of a drag because there's a significant tariff now, you know, due to this trade war we've engaged in with China, unfortunately. And in fact, many of the electric bike companies in the U.S. are suffering because there's a 25% tariff on Chinese e-bikes and e-bike motors. 25%. They don't want to pass along to customers, but I guess they're going to. E-bikes are already a little bit expensive. The Rad Power bike I bought is $1,600. It's pricey. Although, you know, bikes are expensive. Good bikes are expensive. But it's more expensive because it has a motor and a battery and all that. Now I guess it'll be even more. Another 25%. But boy, these are great. And you feel pretty good. You feel pretty green. You're riding around. It's got all the fun of riding a bike, which has always been. I've always enjoyed that. And then there's these scooters, which you're starting to see everywhere. The electric scooters. Taking over cities like crazy. San Francisco actually had to ban them. There were so many of them, and the scooter companies like Bird and Lime and Scoot were just dumping their scooters on the street. And, you know, that's the idea, right? They're all over. You see one, you use your smartphone, you engage it, you ride to where you want, and then you leave it. And you're charged a small, it's not very expensive, small amount of money. Apparently a good business. Some of these companies are the next, people are thinking the next Uber, particularly Lime. Bird was the first one I saw in Santa Monica. Boy, there were birds everywhere. Birds littering the street in Santa Monica. Lime is partially owned by Uber, I believe, or at least started by Uber. And San Francisco kicked them out of town. They said, we can't have hundreds of scooters everywhere littering streets and driveways. It was getting crazy. If you've ever been in Santa Monica, just everywhere. And people are throwing them in the ocean. It's kind of a mess. They need to be a little bit regulated. City of San Francisco decided only two companies would get to have scooters. Lime was not one of them. They sued. They lost. But San Francisco said, we're going to do a test with Scoot. And what was the other one? Skeet? I can't remember. Scoot and Scat? Skip. That's it. Scoot and Skip. But it's the same idea, which is electric powered. I think scooters are a little more dangerous than a bicycle. But that's because I never grew up on scooters. I think that anybody under 25 kind of is comfortable on a scooter, right? Because it started with those... The Razor scooters, right? Everybody had a Razor scooter. All the kids today grew up on Razor scooters, so they're comfortable. Apparently, a bird beef team who's at Purdue says the birds all over our campus are not safe for pedestrians. It's true. They whiz along. They whiz all over the place. Actually, it was pretty bad in Japan, in Tokyo and Osaka. I remember there were people on spikes on the sidewalks and scooters and... And they were whizzing along. It's your job to get out of their way, I think. Robert Bigelow says, it's like I'm working on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. but really, I mean, let's think about it. Isn't this an improvement over a gas-powered vehicles, the electric vehicles? I mean, I drive an electric car, an electric bike, electric Segway. I'm not going to see me on a scooter, though. I like these electric vehicles. 8888 Ask Leo. So, yeah, I guess we could include those, too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Hello, everybody. Let's get back to the phones. Line three is Patrick in Palo Alto. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I called you, I think, 2 months ago. I was asking you about the WhatsApp, and I told you I'd be up in Petaluma to watch your show. I didn't get to make it out there, but I was going to give your son, I think, is learning to drive.
Yes, that's right. You're a driving teacher, you crazy person.
Yeah, exactly.
You teach youngsters how to drive safely. I don't know how you do it, but better you than the parents, right?
Normally, that's what parents say.
Yep.
And as soon as students make a couple of big mistakes, they run into a bush or something.
Let's hope it's just
your bush. Your Tesla should watch for bushes.
It should, but I don't know how well it does. What can I? what can I? I'm not letting my son drive my Tesla. By the way, that ain't happening. He thinks it's happening.
He thinks it's happening.
Ain't happening.
You do the test where you give him a glass of water and say if he can hold it during your acceleration, he can drive. And
then you never happened. Oh, son, you got it all over you. I'm so sorry. What can I do for you, Patrick?
I got one question, my main question, but I have a question about LastPass, actually, based on I hear your commercial a lot, and I've never heard you talk about the password manager on Mac OS. Is that worth anything? Is it worth looking at, or just skip it?
No, it's fine. Apple uses their own keychain mechanism, which is a very secure way to store passwords. I store certificates and other things in keychain, including, of course, my logon password for the Mac. So obviously it's a secure mechanism. The drawback to Apple's keychain is it only works on Apple devices. So I use Android devices, Windows machines. It ain't going to help me there. So I can't use it for a password manager. So if you're all Apple, absolutely. Apple's keychain is fine.
Okay.
And now with iOS 12, by the way, keychain will do autofill, which is really nice.
Yeah. And yeah. I still don't use any keychain, but I've been looking into it, and I've always been waiting for Leo to say something about it.
I should. It's secure. It's a secure technology. It's well done, especially if you have a modern Apple device with a secure enclave, either an iOS device or a T2 based Mac. That makes it even more secure. The keys are stored in that secure enclave. Not the passwords, which is the key to the keychain. The keychain itself is a secure technology. It's using a strong crypto. It will generate, most people don't know this, but it will generate passwords for you. It's a little harder than LastPass. LastPass will offer to generate a password when you're on a website. You have to open up keychain on a Mac to get a password. But you can, and they're long, strong, good passwords, and they're stored in keychain. So it is absolutely a secure technology. It's really a question of maybe convenience more than anything else.
If you're all in on Apple. Okay, well, that's good to know. It's good for me then. I only have a couple of devices and they're all Apple.
So yeah, LastPass is a sponsor, but any password vault will be better than no password vault.
Yeah, that's true. And it's getting hard to memorize all my passwords.
Oh, yeah, you can't. And, of course, then because people can't, they'll end up making up passwords that aren't strong, that are easy to remember is usually insecure. Almost always, if you can remember it, it's a bad idea. And if you have to write it down and put it as a post-it note on the screen, that's a worse idea. So let's. Okay. It would be very nice, I think. It would be very nice to use something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll not share with you my technique.
yes, don't. Almost everybody's technique is bad.
All right. Sounds good. Yeah. So on the security conversation, if I have a friend over to the house,
yes,
and I share my, so I have a, I have Sonic Internet. I have one of their routers with Wi-Fi because it was included in the So it's pretty good. It's got the guest network and all that. And I have it set up so that devices – I have it set up as locked down as I can, and as I need something, I'll open it up. So devices can't talk to each other unless there's specifically a need for them.
Oh, that's great. That's Sonic is a very – SonicNet, Sonic.com is a very good ISP. There are ISP here at the studio. But unfortunately, they're not they're kind of only limited to California area. But, boy, I really like them. And I'm sure that they have a very good router. They wouldn't, you know.
They do. It's great.
Yeah.
It really is.
Unlike other ISPs.
I used my own, and they said, no, you have to use ours because it comes with the sale. You know, I mean, you can use your own, but what do you call it? The special comes
with they're doing, and also they're doing ADSL2, and most routers are confused by that. So, yeah. So, does your router have a guest setting on it?
It does. It's a guest setting. We actually, that's the one we use. We have an iPad that we use in the kitchen just as a generic, you know, surf here and there for recipes and stuff. We have that on the guest. We have the devices that are important on the main. And my concern is if I have, and my concern is I work for a company that gives me a computer and they're not very secure. I mean, I even asked one of the directors one day, I got an email with a link and I said, can I click on this link? Is this legit? I mean, it's supposedly from you guys, but it's this weird.
Boy, the right question to ask. The right question.
Yeah, but he said, yeah, no big deal. He's like, oh, you know, he literally said, take off the aluminum foil hat. And I thought, wow, you guys just click on it.
You need to get the aluminum foil hat on, buddy. You need to put that hat on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not good.
And then I thought, if I connect this to my home network, I have no idea what's on this machine. If I connect it to the guest, what is the probability or how likely or how dangerous is that?
It's just as dangerous as putting it on your home network in most cases. It depends how the guest network is implemented. But so routers with guest networks do not isolate, in most cases, the guest network from the main network. So a malicious machine on the guest network would have access to all the same resources. Is this really all on most routers? All a guest network is a separate password. And it may be that you should ask Sonic, it may be that they have such a good router that it does this. Some routers create virtual LANs or VLANs, and that's what you need. Those are isolated. So, for instance, a Plume router, which I use, has two kinds of guest networks, one with access to network resources, because a lot of times you put somebody on the guest network, you want them to be able to access, I don't know, the Roku box or the music server, right? They have access. But then there's one that's internet only, which is essentially a VLAN. It can only go out. It can't go into the rest of the network. But that's sophisticated. Not all routers, most routers don't do that. They have guest networks, but guest networks are not isolated.
Okay. So I'm looking for a guest network with a VLAN and some isolation.
Yeah.
Okay. And I went, I tinkered into the settings, but I didn't know what I was looking for. I called Sonic. They said that was a little more advanced than their tech support actually does. And they gave me a few forums that I could look at, a couple of wikis. But okay. So essentially, let's assume it's not safe unless I figure out very specifically that this is just a connection to the internet and that's it. And that's really all I need with the work computers to connect back to the home.
Yes. And that's exactly what you should do with a computer that's from the outside world, because you're right, especially if the bosses say, oh, security schmicurity. That thing, who knows what's on that thing? Yeah, you have the right instinct, Patrick. That's like a teenage driver who says, Those median divides, that's just a suggestion, right? You could drive over those, right? Yeah, you definitely want to get something with VLAN capabilities. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo, the phone number, and online for Bob in Danville, California. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Hey, welcome.
I'd like to thank you for the network.
Oh, my pleasure. You're talking about our Twit Podcast Network.
Right. Twit Live.
Thank you. Yeah, this is kind of fun. I mean, we're doing a TV, an internet TV station all about geekery. Twit.tv.
Well, I generally have it on when I'm at my computer.
I always get emails from Brits saying, you know, Twit is an insult. And I say, I know. That's the fun of it. It stands for This Week in Tech. But it's kind of a self-deprecating name. Good. Well, thank you for listening.
Out
I appreciate
really
it.
Well.
Thank you.
About an hour ago now, we were talking about robocalls.
Yes.
And I'm looking for some advice right now.
Okay.
Within a period of about 10 minutes, I received 3 robocalls from Apple Inc.
Yeah, no. Those are not Apple.
Right. No, I understand.
You knew that immediately, yeah.
And in general, we don't answer most phone calls that don't identify the number or, you know, somebody we know.
Right.
My wife answered the phone. She came in and told me it was from Apple Inc. and laughed.
Good.
Which meant she's hung up.
Good.
And then as I was sitting here, 2 more of the same calls came in.
I got, one day, I got a dozen of those, one right after another, some of them from different addresses, which was even weirder. They're all fake. First of all, if Apple were, and they claim that your iCloud has been breached, right?
Right.
Yeah. A, if that were the case, Apple would not use a robocall, right? So, and also, if you listen carefully to these robocalls, most of them are ungrammatical. They're just not, they don't pass the sniff test. You're going to start getting them. I did just the other day from the IRS as well. These are hackers. These are, they're not even hackers. They're scammers who are trying to scam you. And do not call them back. Just delete the call. I wish we could get rid of these. But, you know, these people are operating on the edge of legality. Well, no, they're not even on the edge. They are over the edge of illegality. They don't care about the do not call registry. They're out of the country. It's just bogus. And it's really annoying. And the sad thing is, you're smart, and I'm glad you and your wife laughed. I have to think that some people don't. They call back. They give them their Apple iCloud credentials. Maybe they even give them some money. They fall for it. And that makes me sad.
Well, my concern is that you've said a number of times that these are random calls.
Yeah. Well, in this case, they just kept calling, right?
Random calls come in one right after another suggest no randomness.
Not necessarily. You know, if I gave you a random number and you called it 20 times at the same day, that would still be a random number. Maybe these guys, this points to how cheap it is for them to do this. It costs them almost nothing. That's why spam proliferated in email. For less than a cent, you know, a message, you could send out millions of messages for nothing. And even if only one person bites, it was worth it. Same thing with these. They know most people are going to be smart enough to ignore it, but enough of them are going to respond that it's going to be make it worthwhile. And this is actually a new ploy. That I experienced exactly the same thing. It's the first time I've ever experienced it where they called multiple times. And I guess that's to make you feel like it's more urgent, right?
Well, my concern was that perhaps I'd done something that triggered this. And you've answered my question.
No,
now,
yeah.
So
I was concerned, too. You know what? I don't blame you. I was a little concerned, too. I even logged into my iCloud, even though they say specifically, which is another tell, whatever you do, don't log into your Apple account. I logged into my iCloud just to see if anything was going on, because I figured if Apple's going to, you know, if that were real, you'd also get an email from Apple. And it's highly unlikely that the bad guy who has your phone number would also have your email.
Right.
So you didn't get an email, so we know that that's the case.
All right. Well, I won't worry, and I appreciate your advice.
And I do appreciate your calling, because that tells other people who are listening, you know, not to pay any attention to that. And that's very valuable. I should be saying this all the time. You will not get robocalls from Microsoft, from Apple, from the IRS, from Veterans Affairs, or anybody else. They're not going to robocall you. These are scammers. Unfortunately, they really prey on older people who are maybe a little bit more vulnerable to this because, you know, they're not wily to the ways of the bad, bad world. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. You've helped a lot of people just by bringing it up. And of course, what I immediately did is I knew that, you know, after the second one, Because they'd leave a message. In fact, I was just looking to see if I could find the message. After the second one, I just stopped picking up. But then I noticed they use different numbers. Same robo message, but the calling number changed. Oh, that's smart. That's interesting, isn't it? That's clever. They'll also, now these guys didn't do this, but because they're pretending they're from Apple. And it came from North Carolina. It came from Florida. But those, it didn't really come from any of those places. You also need to understand the way the phone system works. You can, just as you can with email, spoof the sending address. You can spoof the calling number. So the number's meaningless. It's not really where it's coming from. Dr. Mom says, wait till you're 65. Your name gets on thousands of phone number lists. And the spam phone calls go up exponentially. I don't know. I think they're going up exponentially for everybody, Dr. Mom. I think this is just out of control. That's why I was so glad that Ajit Pai and the FCC said, we're going to do something. Let's see. I hope they do. I hope it's not just lip service. It may be that there's nothing you can do. Feels like there is. Feels like there ought to be. Richard in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hello, Richard. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Mr. Leo.
Hello, Mr. Richard.
Yes. I'm the guy that talked to you about an A7N266 motherboard I had for 11 years and died, and I replaced it.
Ah, yes. How'd that go?
Well, I replaced it 10 years ago, and now I'm in the same spot, but I'm having a heck of a time finding.
Yeah.
How do I want to put a good motherboard?
Well, there are good motherboards, but
when I see a motherboard fully laid out for $59.95, I get suspicious.
I don't blame you, but, you know, Asus, Gigabyte.
Yeah.
You know, the same names we've grown up with. They're all still good. I wouldn't get a Packard Bell motherboard or a Kodak or a Polaroid motherboard. But Gigabyte and Asus and Acer, those are all still good names. The thing is, I'm not sure I would recommend. I mean, what are you saving by getting a motherboard? You're saving the case.
Oh, no. No. Well, yeah, I'm doing that because I just like to stay on top of what's going on.
Oh, just for fun. Okay. As long as you're doing it just for fun. Yeah.
You know, yeah. I did this in college. I liked hardware more than I did software.
That's fine. As long as you're doing it just for fun, just understand. I mean, it's a hobbyist thing to do. I mean, anybody who didn't want to tear their hair out might just go out and buy a whole new computer instead of buying a motherboard and trying to get it all back together.
Yeah, but you don't learn much that way.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, these days, I don't know if you learn much anyway. I guess you can see the inside of your computer, but. Let me refer you to PC Perspective, PCPer.com. They're a hardware leaderboard. They talk about motherboards, which brands are good. They even make recommendations. And I trust them. PCPer.com. They like MSI. $65. MSI motherboard. That's in their low-end system. In their medium range system, also an MSI for $70. Motherboards are cheap now. You know, a lot of this stuff has gotten cheaper. The Asus ROG Strikes motherboard is $186. They put that in their high end system. But that's got water cooling pump headers and things like that. I mean, it's got. This is kind of a, and let's see what they do for the Dream system. An MSI $500 motherboard. But that's their high-end system. So, I wouldn't be scared off by a sub-$100 motherboard at all. They're recommending MSI motherboards for $60 and $70. Everything's cheap now. That's the truth of it. Hey, our show today brought to you by Grammarly. Actually, my good grammar is brought to you by Grammarly. We are fans of Grammarly here at the Twit Studios. Everybody uses it. Lisa's a big fan. Grammarly, you might think, is a grammar checker, and it is, but it's a lot more. It's a communication tool, really, that helps you improve your writing. So it's not only mistake-free, it's clear and effective. Lisa has a great example. She's a little, she moves fast. She's a CEO here. She does a lot of stuff. She wears a lot of hats. So occasionally she'll write an email very quickly. Maybe it's a little, maybe its tone might be a little brusque. Grammarly will say, you know, you could make that a little more friendly. It'll actually advise her on that. I like it because sometimes I write and it's not clear. And Grammarly will say, you know, the reading level on that is out of control. Grammarly Premium looks out for spelling. It's a better spell checker than the one built in. Grammar, plus advanced punctuation, structure, style, within context. It's really smart. Vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, readability for different occasions. So, of course, if you're writing an essay for school, that's different than writing a business proposal. And that's different from writing a blog post. And Grammarly understands what you're writing and gives you appropriate suggestions. Improve your writing for every occasion with Grammarly. Use Grammarly while you're updating your resume. You'll get more callbacks. Do it when you're posting items on eBay. You'll get more customers. Write confidently at school, at work, even on the go. Grammarly is awesome. And I'm a great writer, by the way. I'm going to say this. I'm going to toot my own horn. My grammar is excellent. Grammarly still helps a lot. Go to grammarly.com/tech guy. You get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. I install it everywhere. By the way, grammarly.com/tech guy. There's no E in grammar. Two A's. Grammarly.com/tech guy. 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. Grammarly is more than just a grammar checker. It's a communication tool that helps you improve your writing. And we can all use a little help. It's like a, you know what it is? Some people think it's like, oh, your English teacher looking over your shoulder. It's not. It's like a friend, like a really smart friend who's helping you make your writing just a little bit better. 20% off the premium account right now. Grammarly.com/tech guy. David in Florida. Hello, David.
Hey, Leo, how you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing great, bud. Listen, I'm a long-time listener and a first-time caller.
Wonderful. Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks, man. Listen, I'll make it quick. I have a JPay. It's called a JPay 5 tablet from Prism.
Okay.
And I want to see how I can make it where it has internet service. I was thinking about two ideas of maybe just getting a whole other 7-inch tablet and putting the guts inside of it, or maybe if you know of another way I can get internet.
So does it have, it doesn't have probably room for a SIM chip. It doesn't support LTE, you know, like your smartphone does.
No, it has nothing.
It just has, but it must have Wi-Fi, right?
Right, it has a Wi-Fi connection.
Okay. So you can't add, you know, after the fact cellular reception to it, but you could use its own built-in Wi-Fi for internet if you had something that would be a portable Wi-Fi access hotspot. For instance, your smartphone, depending on, you know, your contract with your carrier, your smartphone can also often act as a Wi-Fi hotspot. You turn on hotspotting, you'll have a login and a password. You use that Prism tablet, you log in to the internet provided by the smartphone, and now it's online, even as you travel around. Now, remember, many carriers ask for additional fees for that, sometimes $10-$20 extra a month. It may count against your total bandwidth use, so forth, so on. There are also, you know, all the carriers out there, all the phone companies will sell you essentially a card. It looks like, often looks like a credit card. I call them MiFis, that will get its internet access from the cell network, from LTE, Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile, U.S. Cellular, AT&T, you know, whoever whatever carriers are in your neighborhood. They'll sell you or rent you a card, and you will pay for internet access through that. That will also work with that tablet. So basically what you've got to do is you've got a tablet that only does Wi-Fi. That's the case with most tablets. You need something that will do Wi-Fi as you travel about. And you know, there are a lot of ways to do that. None of them free, I'm sorry to say, but it wouldn't be free if you did it, you know, on the tablet either. You'd have to pay extra. This iPad that I just bought, I paid $150 extra for the cellular modem capability, and then you have to put a SIM card in there from a carrier or In this case, I had one. I have a Google Fi account. Google's resells Sprint, T-Mobile, and U.S. Cellular service under their Fi brand name. And the reason I use Fi for the data chip is you just pay as you go, $10 a gigabyte. So since I don't often use this in the wild, this iPad in the wild, I don't want to pay a regular monthly fee. I just want to pay it for the data that I use, and that's what I do with the Fi card on there. And it works, by the way. People might be surprised to hear that because Google's Fi service only works with Google phones, certain phones made by Google and a couple of other companies. But it turns out the data SIMs will work in a lot of devices. I was using it in a Windows, HP NVX2 Windows tablet. It usually identifies as T-Mobile only. It may not be doing the cross-network stuff that Google Fi does on Fi-enabled phones. But it works, and it's $10 a gigabyte. and the other thing I like about Fi is after 6 gigabytes of data, they stop charging you. So it never is more than $60 a month. So that might be a good choice for you. You can go to fi.google.com and find out about that. You'd have to set up a Fi account. Somebody in the chat room is saying that Big Pee-wee's got to play topical music. When I mention the FCC, for instance, Big Pee-wee, Chumley says you should play Disco Inferno. I don't know. That might be a stretch. We don't need to editorialize on the content of the show. But I have to say, I've been hard on Ajit Pai. I'm still not happy about net neutrality, although we did win a court victory on net neutrality. You know, the issue, of course, is the FCC used to say, you know, internet service providers can't slow down or block traffic because it's competitive. But maybe it's not dead yet. The FCC, reversed that regulation that let them regulate internet service providers. But the Supreme Court, just a few days ago, declined to review a decision from the D.C. Circuit Court upholding the open internet rule. The Supreme Court effectively said, nope, the Circuit Court got it right. So maybe we have some friends in the Supreme Court when it comes to net neutrality. The House is also looking at net neutrality rules. And I do think this is very important. The internet, a free flow of ideas and information over the internet, is absolutely critical to this country and to innovation and to democracy. And it shouldn't be in the hands of any internet service provider to slow down, block, or in any way affect your access, your full and free access to the internet, especially for competitive reasons. And we're starting to see that, by the way. We're starting to see internet service providers slow down Skype because they provide phone services as well. That's exactly what the net neutrality rules were created to protect. Skype has stopped working in certain internet service providers because they just, well, they have no incentive to make it work. So this is why these rules are so important. You don't want to have to pay extra to get Netflix just because Comcast offers TV services. That's just wrong. So some good news. And of course, we were talking earlier about robocalls, and the FCC does seem to be taking a hard line on stopping this ridiculous epidemic. It's essentially made smartphones, cell phones of any kind, worthless because I feel bad for people who have to answer the phone regardless of numbers. I just ignore any number I don't know. But that's a luxury, especially if you're a business, if you're a doctor, you got to answer the phone. And if more often than not, that's a spam call or a robocall, that makes that smartphone useless. So we got to solve this one. And I'm glad to see the FCC step into this. If you listen to the show and you want to know more about the things we talk about, we try to put links and more in there. James DeRuvo is writing everything I talk about down. Josh Windisch in our office gets our pick of the week, our tip of the week, puts that up there too. And it's all free. There's no sign up. We don't want your email address. It's there for you to use. TechGuyLabs.com. We even put audio and video of the shows after the fact up there, too. So if you miss a show, you can go back and watch it again. TechGuyLabs.com. Thanks to Kim Schaffer for our phone angel, for answering the phones today. Thanks to Big Pee-wee for making the music. We'll see you later, Michael. Good luck to you. Thanks to you, most of all, for joining us. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.